Fisher, I'm just from up a little north in Perrysburg area. We're sure, because I'm going to Rome, so that will just be something for me to trip on. We're up in the Perrysburg area. We're part of Main Street Church up there, and I just appreciate the option to be here with you this morning and share from God's Word, something I really love to do. And we're going to look at a story about a young woman named Ruth. Probably many of you are familiar with the story. It's one of the Old Testament books named for her, and it's a book that is really good to look at simply because I think we have a tendency to oversimplify it. It's this lovely, heartwarming story where God takes care of his people, and it's very easy to just get stuck on that, especially if there's this impassioned speech by the person Ruth that we just really love, and it really is heartwarming to us, so we like that. But it's actually, interestingly, one of the pivotal books in the Bible for us. Because if you look at it from the big perspective of God's plan, and always, as we look at the Bible, I think we have to constantly hone ourselves back in on God's plan. Because that's the overarching thing over all of this. From Genesis to Revelation, God's plan is at work through the whole thing. And we have to keep reconnecting ourselves with that plan. Otherwise, we're just going to get in trouble, which is what Israel did a lot. So it's really good to look at the Bible from that perspective of God's plan. And this book really hones right in on it because we see some pivotal pieces in here. But I want to kind of do, we're going to look at Ruth chapter 2. But before we start on that, I got to give a little background then and tie into God's plan, which anytime you look at a particular passage of Scripture, it's always good to step back and go, okay, how does this fit in the big picture? Where does this fit in the whole of the Bible? It also helps us not take things out of context. So just a good thing to do. So if you look back over the whole of the Bible, think in terms of God's plan. It's always been about relationship with us, right? From creation, he made the whole world. Everything he made built up to the point of him making human beings. And that for the sake of relationship with him. Immediately, he starts into interaction with Adam and Eve and begins to build a relationship. And we find through the whole of the Bible, God is constantly about building, enhancing, furthering this relationship we have with him, leading up to the community in heaven that we read about in Revelation. That is the ultimate goal. God's building a community of people that live loving and caring for each other, as opposed to all the fighting we see all through the Bible and all through history. So you start from Revelation. We have a relationship established right away. And immediately as we go through the Old Testament, God keeps building that relationship. You get to the point of Noah, where things have been so tumultuous. People have struggled so much at following God, at listening to him in the relationship, that he sends the flood to wipe everything out. But he establishes clear relationship there when he tells Noah and his family, I won't do this again. This was necessary here, but I won't do this again. So things continue on, and again, it's tumultuous. It's up and down. Half the time we're following him, more often, actually less than half the time, because more often we're not. We're just straying. We're not listening to him. So he gets to the point of Abraham and his son Isaac and grandson Jacob, and he establishes something more of a relationship. It's got a little more depth to it, a little more substance to it. And it's built around that family. We get through the end of Genesis, and that family has built up into a nation. And now God begins to even more fully develop that relationship through the person of Moses and following him, Joshua. He establishes an even fuller relationship that has a lot more spelled out in terms of, this is what I'm going to do, God's saying, and this is what you need to do. For this relationship to be healthy, this is what needs to happen. And so we end up with three more books after the book of Exodus, where that's spelled out. The next three books spell out the fullness of all that relationship. So there's the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, getting to the point of a more full relationship and more clarity to it, more understanding. And yet, people still struggle to live in that relationship, to hold up our end of the agreement. It's a covenant established, and that covenant says, we're going to listen to God. We're going to follow God. When he says, live like this, we're going to do it. So, next couple books right after the Pentateuch are Joshua and Judges. Joshua is where he establishes them in a land, gives them a place to live and be a country. And he also starts to spell out this special relationship we have with you as a nation that is my people, as he calls them, is for the sake of the whole world to see what it means to have a healthy relationship with God, what it means to live in him. Okay? So Joshua's pretty positive, although we all know all the way up to that point there's been lots of ups and downs, lots of times where they go, we're not quite sure if we should be doing this, and they want to go run some other way or do some other thing. It gets worse when they get into Judges, because the book of Judges is now that they're in a land, they have a place, it's the first time in the day-to-day living they're trying to live out this relationship with God has spelled out with them, and they fail more often than not. It's a book with a lot of tragedy, a lot of bad decisions, some people treating other people terribly, inhumanely, in ways they never should, and God having to step in a number of times and fix things, and he does. But by the end of the book of Judges, it's really clear that human beings struggle living in this relationship God's established. Something different needs to happen, and here's why Ruth is so pivotal. Because the difficulty is that everything was looked at as just a bunch of hoops to jump through. God gives us 10 commandments that say, don't kill, don't steal, don't want everybody's other stuff. And we go, all right, we can do that. Don't kill, don't steal. But we're constantly bending the rules because our hearts are still wanting to steal everybody's stuff. Our hearts are still wanting to kill somebody. So somehow, this relationship with God, this way he wants to live, has to become a deeper part of who we are. It has to get into our hearts. It has to get into our character. We have to see the value in it. We have to see this isn't just hoops to jump through to make God happy. These things he says we should do are for our own health and well-being. It's a better way to live. And this is what we see in Ruth. Ruth really gives the first clear demonstration of what does it look like to have God's way be a better way to live, not just because somebody jumped through the hoops, but because they got it in their heart. They made it part of their character. Through the rest of the Bible, this notion develops into this idea of the heart of God's law versus the letter of God's law. It eventually gets expressed in Jeremiah's prophecy in chapter 31, and then later, so we know this carries all the way through in the time of the early Christians, in the book of Hebrews, it's repeated in the 8th chapter, where it tells us this. This kind of encapsulates this idea of the heart of God's law. Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds. I will write them on their hearts. And I will be their God. And they shall be my people. That idea carried from Jeremiah all the way through the Old Testament, Christ came and took it even further. When he died on the cross for us and sent his Holy Spirit, now his Holy Spirit's living in us. So when you say he's going to be in our minds and in our hearts, that's how it gets that fully there. But we still need to, over and over again, reacquaint ourselves with the value of God's just giving us a better way to live. Because we have so many distractions that we still get caught up in all the stuff going on around us and just kind of forget sometimes that just living godly character is simply a better way for us to live. And so sometimes we need to step back and look at these simple stories like the book of Ruth. Completely different culture. So hard for us to relate to. Centuries old. And yet, if we step into the story for a minute, we find that God's still got a message that my plan for you, this idea of you living out, getting into your hearts, my character, valuing the better way I'm giving you to live, has so much depth and meaning for you. It's just like it was for these people centuries ago. So let me synopsize really quickly chapter 1, because you have to have kind of some idea where the story starts. First of all, I do have to tell you, just so we know that the ending, because this story stands in contrast to Judges. Judges was tumultuous and people struggling to follow God. The last verse of the book of Judges, if I can find it here, says this. I think this is just really interesting that an entire book of the Bible ends with this one last verse. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. What kind of world is that? You look sometimes around you at the world we're living in now and think, everybody just does whatever they want. And what a craziness is that? What kind of world are we living in, do we say sometimes? That was their world. So, different culture, different time, different people, very different circumstances, and yet they're living in the same place where everyone just does as they see fit. And then the book of Ruth opens up, tells us, first of all, it's in the time of Judges. So same time frame when everyone does whatever they want. It introduces us to a family, a man named Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And this family right away faces tragedy. If we're going to look at godly character, let's not do it in the nice rosy days where it's sunshine and flowers. This is a little bit like the book of Job. Remember, Job, Satan says to God, oh, look, he's just following you because you're treating him well. Give him a little trouble, and this guy's going to crumble. This is similar. This is a family trying in a time when everybody's just doing what they want. This is people trying to follow God, trying to truly follow him with their character. And yet they face tragedy right away. It says there's a famine in the land. Hard for us to relate to because there's Walmart and Meijer and everything close by to give us all the food we need. But famine for them was natural disaster of the worst kind. When famine hit your land, you seriously didn't know if you were going to be alive at the end of the year. Or maybe at the end of the month. Famine was tragedy. So we have tragic circumstances. And then, of course, what fun is tragic circumstances without some bad decision-making to help it out, right? So this family decides to go live for a time in the neighboring country of Moab. Seems harmless, but here we have the Jewish people just introduced to this special relationship with God where he says, I want you to live a specific, special way that isn't like the rest of the world around you that's just doing whatever they want. It's specific. It's unique. You're going to have to focus on it, and don't let yourself get distracted by all this stuff that everybody's doing around you. So they were supposed to try to be separate. The word holy means separate. He called them to be holy. Don't be like the neighboring countries around you. And Moab was one that was specifically known to not honor God. So there's big tension. They don't like each other. They don't get along. And Israel is supposed to stay away from Moab. So here we have a time of famine. This nation of Israel is supposed to be following God, trusting God to take care of them. And they're going, let's head to Moab so we can get some food. So I'm sure somebody looked at him and said, you shouldn't be doing that. God's point here isn't to try to like ding every single bad decision. It's not about, we're humans, we're going to make mistakes. So this story isn't about honing in on bad decisions and don't ever make a bad decision. It's what does good godly character like look like even in the midst of tragedy, even in the midst of bad decisions. So they go and the man Elimelech dies. So now his wife, Naomi, is a widow. And her two sons marry women from the country of Moab, where they have stayed for about 10 years. Okay? Now the bad decisions are clearly bad decisions because, understandably, maybe in a time of famine, you're desperate for food. It's understandable you went over to Moab. But you should definitely not intermarry because that's just going to make it very difficult for you to live out this godly character if you're intermarrying with people who specifically don't honor God. That's just a recipe for disaster. So they clearly shouldn't have done that. But again, this isn't about dinging the bad decisions because we pass these bad decisions quickly. The son-in-laws die. Now the focal point of we have three women, Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth. And in this culture, that is the worst kind of tragedy. It's a patriarchal culture. Good, bad, right, or wrong, that is the way it was. And in that culture, if you were females, unattached to any male, you were desperate and desolate. There was no way for you to survive. Everything, financial, legal, inheritance, land, protection, everything revolved around the male head of the household. And if you were three females living in a world that was frequently violent, had spats and fights going on constantly, everybody bickering over everything, and you had no protection, no legal rights, nothing, you were in danger. I mean, they seriously were like, now you're not likely to survive the week, every week. So this is the worst level of tragedy these women find themselves in. But here's where we start to see in the story the character pieces show up. Because as we, I'm kind of jumping through chapter 1 because I want to get to chapter 2. The next thing we see is that Naomi then hears that there's food back in Bethlehem. They're from the town of Bethlehem, which is in Israel. And she hears that there's food. It's kind of interesting to note that she specifically hears that God has provided Israel with bread. She's from Bethlehem, which means house of bread. So she heard God gave bread to the house of bread, and she's headed back there. But we're going to get some clues pretty quickly that we're going to see clues that Naomi is truly a woman of God trying to follow God's character, but she's struggling deeply because of the circumstances she's in. So she realizes the best thing for her is to head back. But these two girls from Moab, we're going to see highlighted very much so the significance of them being foreigners to Israel is a big deal. So she tells these two girls, you need to go home to your family. Interestingly, highly patriarchal culture. And she doesn't say, you need to go home to your fathers, who is the head of the household. He is the one who would allow them to come back and live in his house again. She says, you need to go home to the home of your mother. Just an interesting note that even in a patriarchal culture, women had influence. The culture may choose this way of living, but still, God made people equally, and women had influence in that culture. And it also tells us the desperate level they were at, that it was like, go home and beg of your mother. She's the one that's going to have influence over the father who's going to make the decision. And she's the one that you're potentially going to convince, like a beggar, that she should let you come back and live in the household. Because a female is just another mouth to feed from a household perspective. So we're all beggars. You should go back and beg for your mother to let you come home so you can survive. Here's where it gets even more interesting, though. Both girls say, no, we're staying with you. Now, this story really gets honed in on the impassioned, probably a lot of you are familiar with the impassioned plea of Ruth, don't make me go away from you. She does this beautiful speech that we love to play at weddings, and it is beautiful. But we focus in so much on Ruth's faithfulness in this, which is beautiful, but it almost makes you kind of miss the point when we get honed in on that so much, where we should be asking ourselves the question, wait a minute, why? Why in this incredibly dangerous situation are these two girls from Moab, they're in their home country, even if they have to go home to their families as beggars, they'll be known to those people, they'll know those people. And they both say, no, we want to, in this dangerous situation, go with you to this foreign place where people are most likely going to mistreat us horribly. We won't know anybody, the culture will be unfamiliar. We'll be so out of place, we'll struggle fitting in forever, but take us with you. Make yourself stop and ask that question. Why did both of these girls say, we should go home, we should go with you? Now, one of them, Naomi does convince, go back to your family. Orpah does that. But then Ruth does this impassioned plea that most of us are familiar with, that has vows and promises that sound like a wedding vow. I'm bound to you. I am never leaving you. Even deeper, we should be asking, why? Why is this girl doing such a foolish thing? And here's what I want to suggest. The implications we see are that Naomi is a woman of God, not just jumping through the hoops to follow God, but she's a woman developing godly character. She's a woman getting hold of the heart of God's law, not just as hoops to jump through, but as recognizing this is a better way for me to live. so much better, she began to teach it to her daughter-in-laws. This is what it means to live as God teaches us. It's so significant, it's so compellingly different than how humans choose to live on their own, that we should do this. And the way Ruth is binding herself to Naomi, something compelling has to be driving that. I say it's Naomi has taught her, has mentored her on what godly character looks like. When she's speaking to the daughters, and she tells them, each of them should go home. Naomi says, may the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and me. We're going to hear, with one exception in here, we're going to hear Naomi and another character frequently bring God into the conversation. Almost every time they talk about God's blessing. May the Lord deal with you kindly, as you did to me. And when she says to me, she's the living and the dead is the two sons that have died. You were good to my sons. Naomi's character is focused in on God's ways. God's like integral in every part of her life. And she taught her daughter-in-laws to be this way too. When Ruth says, I'm going with you and your people are going to be my people, your God is going to be my God, I don't think she's just doing a great, sounds great speech. I think she means it. This God you've learned to live by, who teaches a better way to live, that's everything. I want to be part of that. I want to follow that God. And we're going to see more indications of that, because it's a really interesting little switch goes on here. Naomi, this godly woman, is now moving in this direction. So her and Ruth head back to Bethlehem. They get to Bethlehem. And when they're there, the whole town's all astir. And they go, oh, look, is this Naomi come back home after 10 years? And Naomi says, don't call me Naomi, which, by the way, means pleasant. She says, call me Mara, which means bitter. And she goes through three different descriptions of how God has afflicted her. What happens when a person of godly character feels like God's afflicted them? The strength of the wording she uses, one of the words is the word to strike, as with a fist. God struck me. The last word she uses is a word that commonly means broken. She also in the middle says, I went away full, I came back empty. God struck me, God emptied me, and now I'm broken. So here we are, right at the beginning of chapter 2. Naomi, a woman of godly character, is broken. Ruth, like a new Christian, she's a new God follower. She's got her heart in it, but she doesn't know. You don't hear her talk about God as much because it's not quite ingrained into her as fully yet. But she's kind of like a new Christian. And then we're going to have a third character come into this. So we have this mix of characters, dirt poor, filthy rich, new Christian, seasoned Christian, Christian who's broken, or God follower who's broken. And that's where chapter 2 starts. And so we hear, verse 1 of chapter 2, now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. A couple interesting things just in those first few verses. First of all, now we know a couple things. Ruth really is starting to, she's clearly been mentored by Naomi because she is understanding this faith of following God, because she says, let me go into the fields and glean amongst those who are harvesting. She's referring to a law that God put in place for the people of Israel that the rest of the world didn't have. This is a specific God law that says when harvesters are getting the crops, as they cut them down, they shouldn't gather up everything they cut down. At the edges of the field, they should leave some laying so poor people don't starve, essentially. So beggars and or widows and orphans may come and gather the gleanings. That's what it was to glean, is you came and gathered that what was left over by God's law. So Ruth, becoming familiar with God's law as a way of life, says, hey, we need some food. I'm going to go try to gather. And here's where we know that Naomi is absolutely done. We know she's a woman of godly character. We know she cares deeply about these girls. It seems she's really mentored them in the ways of God. But when it comes to going out and doing this act of gathering some food so they don't starve, she just says, yeah, go ahead. No, that's not right for her, because she cares about this girl. And yet, if anybody's going to go and act this support God's given, it should be Naomi. Naomi's from Israel. They know her. When she walks in that field, they'll probably snicker and go, yeah, Naomi ran off to Moab for food, and look what she's having to do now. So she'll get some derision, but she'll be respected, and she'll be allowed without problems to gather the crops. Notice every time now, we're going to see frequently through the rest of this chapter, every time we refer to Ruth almost, it's Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth from Moab, Ruth the foreigner. It's the most significant thing for Ruth. She is out of place here, and they're going to most likely mistreat her. She should expect to be mistreated. She is trusting in God because she's saying, I'm going to go and hope to find somebody's favor, because she knows unless she does, she's likely going to be mistreated in some kind of bad way. And Ruth, or Naomi, doesn't give her any lecture about how to do this safely, where she should go. Notice it just said, this new guy in the story, Boaz, who's wealthy, is related to Elimelech, her dead husband. So wealthy means he owns fields, because it's agricultural society. She should be going, when you go to these particular fields in this part of town. No, she just says, yeah, all right. So Naomi's done. Note that. Ruth is boldly just trusting in God to help her find the right place, and God's providence did land her in the fields of Boaz. So God's providence really did come in and help out here, and we get the first little glimpse of the new guy in town, or the new character in the story, Boaz. Right away we see an indication that he is also likely a man of godly character. Listen to the first thing that comes out of his mouth. The Lord bless you. And his field workers reply in kind. God's part of their conversation. Everyday conversation, God's part of it. This is the kind of character they've built. So, starting at verse 5, then Boaz said to his servant, who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? The servant in charge of the reapers said, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And he said, please let me, and she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. Then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. So, first we get Boaz's worker, his foreman in charge of the fields, notes Ruth's character. She's been working hard all day. When it says, by the way, she's just been in the house a little bit, they had a little rest shelter. But what it's really saying is she's only taken a short break to go sit in that rest shelter. He's specifically noting she's been hard at work. He first notes she's the Moabite. Got to keep in mind that she's a foreigner. But he also notes her character. And Boaz's response is nothing short of amazing. Again, these stories are like different cultures, and it's so far away that it's sometimes easy to kind of miss. But Boaz's response is amazing. But even in our culture, if we think about it, think like a businessman. Boaz is the wealthy guy, right? He owns the fields. Even if he's a good character businessman, he's concerned for his workers and his crops, and this is what it is to be in business, right? We just can't help. When we're about business, we're about business. We take care of the stuff. He's going to be concerned about his workers and his crops and everything. Here's a foreigner, a Moabite foreigner. Moabites are known to not honor God, so they're not trusted by this culture. So think business response, which also fits the culture of where this is. From a business perspective, most likely, if a foreigner like this walked into a field, the top guy would want to be the intimidating, keep an eye on her, make sure she doesn't step out of line. He'd be giving instructions to his foreman to keep this in check. We have a thing that might disrupt the normal operations of our food, of our survival here. And so let's keep a lid on this. Let's watch her. Let's make sure we're a little intimidating so she's careful not to step out of line. Boaz should be trying to be intimidating to this woman from a worldly perspective. And when I worldly mean worldly, I just say outside of God teaching us a different way to live, a better way to live, human nature is we're going to become businesslike and protective and want to protect our stuff. It's kind of part of who we are. That's a lot of what drives us. And so from that worldly perspective, he should not have responded like he did. He's protective of her. He's generous to her. He's gracious to her. Keep your eyes on this field. I've told my men not to touch you. The potential for her to be touched by somebody in some kind of bad way is huge. And he specifically said, I told my men not to touch you, so you should keep behind my girls, because there you'll be safe. Don't wear yourself out. When you're thirsty, go get a drink of water. God's law says he has to leave some crops for her to pick up. It doesn't say he has to share his water with her, but he does. He's generous and says, come, drink some of the water. Stay with my people. Be safe. Now, is Boaz just, foolish? Is he just misunderstanding God's law to just always be nice to everybody? No, there's other places in Scripture we see godly people dealing with people with very worldly perspectives, and they're not always just treated nice just because we're all about just being nice and sweet and kind all the time. What's different is he's looking at her character. Listen to what comes next. This is right after he says, when you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. Verse 10, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner? Boaz replied to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not know previously. May the Lord reward your work, and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me, and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. She's keenly still aware of her status as a foreigner. She knows how lowly she should be regarded. What did he look at? This is where you really see the depth of godly character. He doesn't look at the labels that fit her really well. She's a foreigner. She's a Moabite. She's a woman. She's all these different things that he can clearly figure out and respond to out of a little safe way of dealing with people. Instead, he looks at her as a person. He learns about her. I have heard what you did. You're caring for your mother-in-law. You have chosen to follow the God that we follow. When he says, God under whose wings you have taken refuge, that's an Israelite way of saying choosing God as your God. You come under God's wing and he protects you. She's turned to God for protection, and he's saying, when you turn to God for protection, I'm going to help God protect you. I'm going to help keep you safe. But notice also that in this whole exchange, they're both feeling the sense of blessing. When godly people interact, there's mutual blessing. Now, there's one other really important piece to see, but I will do spoiler alert because we're not catching chapters 3 and 4 where the story ends. Probably a lot of you already know it, but just in case you don't, I'm going to do the spoiler stuff here and now. In chapters 3 and 4, Naomi ends up coaching Ruth to say, hey, this is a relative, and this engages another of God's laws about the kinsman redeemer, which is when a Jewish man dies, if he leaves a widow, if there is a close male relative, he should marry that woman in order to keep her safe, keep her connected in the community. Okay, that's a responsibility. And so any close relative could, should take on that role. And so Naomi coaches Ruth to say, hey, this is a guy who could be a kinsman redeemer, coaches Ruth how to go and essentially say, if you would marry me and engage this kinsman redeemer thing, I would be grateful. That's very paraphrase of what it's saying, but that's how the story ends, because he again, very graciously, again, expresses this sense of having been blessed by her. He keeps saying it as if, like, he's not doing anything special. He's being blessed by seeing this godly character lived out in her, so that as he's helping take care of her, he's blessed by the character she's portraying. And he says, I will absolutely marry you. And he goes and he follows the correct practices. He has to go make sure there isn't another closer kinsman, and there is one. He has to make sure that person doesn't want to do it, and this guy doesn't. So Boaz marries her. They have a baby. And here's the big deal. That baby, first of all, is a grandchild to Naomi. Remember Naomi, who was absolutely shut down? Story ends with Naomi sitting with this baby on her lap. Do you think she's empty now? Probably a full diaper, but she's not empty anymore. And that's the big thing in the end. Also kind of important, that baby becomes the genealogical predecessor to King David, who's the genealogical predecessor to Jesus. So now Ruth, the foreigner, outsider, who knew nothing else but a worldly way to live, is mentored by a good, godly woman who teaches her to appreciate to the depths of her heart what it means to follow God. And she is now part of the story of Jesus coming and taking that relationship to its fullest. Is that a blessing for Ruth? Here's another little blessing for Ruth. So verse 14, this is the very end of where she's been off in the fields. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out from some grain from the bundles, and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left over after she was satisfied. Her mother-in-law then said to her, where did you glean today? And where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead. Again, Naomi said to her, the man is our relative, and he is one of our closest relatives. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, so that the others do not fall upon you in another field. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. That's the end of chapter 2. So we still see at the very beginning of that, Boaz continuing to bless her in like generosity. Come and have lunch with us. Again, something you didn't need to do. But you hear the thing he said again, protecting. When he says don't insult her, he really means don't attack her in any way. It's not just insult verbally, but just leave her alone. He's still protecting her. But he's also being extremely generous. When he says pull some of the stuff out and leave it behind, all my notes falling on the floor. Now we're done. When he says leave some behind for her, and it says she gets to the end of the day, she beats out. So you go to the threshing floor and you bang all these stalks until the grain all comes off, and she gathers it up and takes it home. It's an ephah of barley. Okay, this is first day. She left, remember, done Naomi, spent, shut down Naomi, who's just going, yeah, go off to the fields and maybe we'll survive today. Naomi's expecting her to come home maybe with enough food for a couple days, after which they're back to trying to figure out how to survive again. And Ruth comes home with enough grain to feed them for weeks and some leftover lunch. Naomi doesn't have to wait to bake bread to eat. You know how long it's probably been since she's eaten at this point? And she goes, here's some bread, eat. Here's enough grain that we can live for weeks. And you hear the lights coming on. Like, Naomi was shut down, but do you hear the lights coming on when Naomi is saying, now I got to see if I can find my place, and everything's upside down, but I'll find it. Give me a minute, I'll get there. So first of all, right off the bat, you know, early Naomi was frequently involving God in the Lord bless you. It was always on her tongue until that point when she was shut down. And immediately when she sees, her mother-in-law said, where did you glean? Where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. She's back to blessing. This is like Ruth comes home having left this woman who's absolutely emotionally spent and shut down. And she comes home and watches the lights come back on, watches the flame flicker up. And early on, when Naomi was talking to the girls to send them home, she talks about them having been good to her and the dead, right? Good to her and the dead, her two sons that had died. Now she says this blessing after Ruth says, the name guy I worked with today is Boaz. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, this is verse 20, may he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. Who are the living and the dead here? Ruth is the living. She's living enough to go out and find a way to survive and engage this law and go to the fields and take a risk and trust God. Naomi was the dead. Naomi's going, I was dead when you left this morning. Physically, I didn't think I would survive today or tomorrow, but emotionally, mentally, faith-wise, she was dead. And Ruth gets to be part of watching her come to life right in front of her eyes. God showed us kindness. God influenced this man of character to treat us with such generous kindness that we are not in this terrible state. Even at this moment, long before the baby comes, long before Naomi is bouncing the baby on her knee, what do you think it was like for Ruth, this young God follower, new to following God, new to really learning? What does it mean? Is it meaningful for me to live with godly character? Is it really beneficial to me? And she gets to watch this woman she loves come back to life right in front of her eyes. There's the value of godly character. How old is this story? How hard is it to relate to? We don't struggle for food, anything like they do. We don't know what it's like to live in a weird patriarchal culture. We don't talk like they do. But we know what it's like to be the rich guy who gets to be the stable one, keeping everything together, and still be part of God's plan and watch God take care of every little person. We know what it's like to be the broken person when the circumstances of life make you feel like your faith is done. And then come alive again and find out God's still there. He's still taking care of us. The story is as much for us as it was for them back then. And if you're following Jesus here today and you haven't had a chance yet to see what it's like when God takes a person who feels like they're dead and brings them back to life, stick with godly living. When you see him do it, you'll be amazed to be part of God's plan. It's hard in this world when stuff seems chaotic, people seem to just do whatever they want, nothing seems to matter. And we can sometimes question, is it valuable for me to live godly? I don't see it having any impact. But our faith is about trusting that godly character has value simply because this is a better way to live. It's worth it to follow it simply because there is no better plan. We have to constantly keep ourselves reoriented to God's plan. And remember that you may be as simple as some simple little girl from the country of Moab who is an outsider and nobody. When you're tied into God's plan, it's amazing. Amazing things will happen. It's not stored up just for King David and Moses and all the big characters who did all the dramatic things. This is normal, everyday people. By the way, these are real people. This isn't a parable. This isn't a made-up story. These are real people. Simple, real people, just like all of us. They didn't do anything grandiose. They tried to survive in an agricultural society where you just needed food. But they got to see God at work and what it means to live as God's children. And we get to see the same thing. Let's pray together.